Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the fourth episode of the Linux Experiment Podcast. It's been a bit of a while, but we got everybody together for like a reunion podcast to see who Jake got married to.
Just a bit of a while.
Reunion.
So for everybody who doesn't remember, we'll start off by kind of going around the room, introducing ourselves and, you know, like, what the fuck you been up to, Tyler?
Well, John, didn't know you were going to throw across the room right to me the first time.
Okay, yeah, dude, it's all you.
Start on this corner. It's all good. Not a whole lot. Just, you know,
same. No, I meant like with Linux, not with your life, douche.
No, you know what? But that's exactly what I'm getting at. Like,
it's a pitiful empty shell.
Yeah.
Well. I have to write in my live journal every day, but my Flash client isn't compatible with my personality quizzes that I want to put in there.
Yeah. Flash on Linux. We'll get to that. We'll get to that.
No, we won't.
Yeah, probably not. There's too many other grievances.
All right, Tyler, what's happening?
You know, not a whole lot. Like I said, installed Mint. It's good. I honestly don't have any complaints about it. It's Linux, and it seems to work, and it doesn't have any problems. And I there seems to be a prevailing thought on the internet about how when you switch to Mint, that's pretty much the end of distro hopping. And for me, I honestly think that is the case because it's just so easy that there's no incentive for me to go elsewhere, essentially.
Dude, I agree with you 100%. We're recording this podcast on Linux Mint, which I'm running on my desktop. I run the new Ubuntu at work, and I run Fedora 12 on my laptop, and Mint is just fucking pristine, man. It's sweet.
Yeah, it's very streamlined.
I mean, it's if you want that whole Apple thing, like, it just works. It really does. You install it and your audio works. Holy shit. You have a Flash plugin. Holy shit. You've got all the non-free codecs. Oh my God, I can watch a DVD. It's really quite nice.
It's what Linux should be, really, but...
Well, I mean, it's like if Linux wants to gain market share, you know, and of course, and neckbeards listening to this are all like, oh, whatever, fuck, man, but... You know, if you want to...
What's market share?
Yeah, exactly.
It's all about the freedom.
If you want to compete with Windows or Mac, Linux Mint is definitely what I would recommend to friends and family.
Well, and actually, it brings up an interesting topic. It's the whole freedom versus functionality side of Linux, where do you want, you know, the freedom to have it all open source software? Do you only want to accept things like that, like the whole Debian style of doing things? Or do you want the functionality that... Ubuntu tries to do, but Linux Mint really excels at.
Well, Linux Mint is just polished Ubuntu, isn't it? I mean, that's certainly what it feels like anyway.
It's polished. Like, Ubuntu is pretty polished on its own, and then Mint just takes it another step above that, really. And it's not like you're sacrificing that freedom at all, because you can still do anything you want. Everything just sort of comes packaged nicely and working out of the box. You can... adjust things from there. If you want to go like completely the Linux way, that you're in a completely packaged environment, what was that one I was using, Jake? The Cloud OS.
Oh, Jolly Cloud.
Jolly Cloud.
Like
Jolly Cloud. I was using, and what a terrible operating system.
Oh. We're still waiting for that post, by the way.
What was Jolly Cloud's deal? I've never heard of it.
Jolly Cloud is a netbook operating system. Where you're basically sort of locked into this dashboard.
Oh, so like, so it's Chrome like, OS?
Sort of, but it would be like it would be like if you had like your Xbox dashboard as a computer, and you can go into a browser and you can install apps, but only apps that they've like put into their
You don't have like a package manager or whatever.
You do, but you can't install any package that you want.
Is there local storage?
Yes. Huh. It works best when you're connected, obviously.
Okay, so have you used the Ubuntu Netbook Remix beta? And if so, how does it stack up? Like, are they similar in ideas? Or?
Well, no, because Ubuntu Netbook is just optimized for the netbook. You're not necessarily sacrificing anything.
You could still call up a terminal and Netbook Remix if you wanted.
You can still do anything you want.
So this Cloud OS, then, it's very limited?
Yeah, Jolly Cloud is very limited. Cloud. Yeah.
I got it mixed up with Chrome
OS. It wasn't horrible. It was just like, and it would work well for someone who is just using it for browsing and stuff like that.
Well, that's my question for it. I mean, like, what's their target market? Like, who are they? What's their audience? What are they looking for?
That's what I was trying to get at. I mean, most of the netbook manufacturers use something else I forget the distro that they're shipping on the PCs.
There's Zandros, and there's a few others.
Yeah, but they've been shipping this thing where it's sort of their own little flavor, and it's similar to Mint, and it's more geared towards the user experience for people that have never heard of Linux before. This you'd think it would be more for, like, no one's shipping it. So I'm not sure exactly who they're targeting. It would be sort of a beginner user, though, who would be using it.
I would argue, though, that Linux needs a beginner user, something that I could give to my grandmother, quite literally, to just check her email or whatever.
Yeah.
Ubuntu tries to do that, but they let their freedoms get in the way. You know what I mean? They're all like, we're going to strip out the MP3 playback and the DVD playback and shit. Well, guess what? I mean, I understand where you're coming from, but for the average person, that's just not going to cut it.
Well, right? And I'll give you an example firsthand. Recently, I after a horrendous Linux virus,
Linux virus.
Oh, it started.
A Windows virus that destroyed my dad's work machine. I gave him the option of installing Linux after I told him, it does, for what you do, it's probably going to suit your needs. It's never going to get a virus, in the foreseeable future, at least. And you won't have to worry about it, and I won't have to get a phone call midday going, oh my God, there's so much porn everywhere. So,
oh my God, the porn is everywhere.
I
wish we all had that problem.
Well, I do. I mean, that's what my computer is like. Honestly, if you go out of our door, it's just porn everywhere.
In any event, after spending some time installing it and getting it up to speed, it works fine for him, and he seems to enjoy it because it is just, what he needs to do, and there's no bullshit getting in the way. But the main problem still exists, is that you have to know someone who's at least somewhat familiar or skilled with Linux in order to set it up to that point. Mint's almost there, but it's still not quite, I couldn't give a disk to my grandma and say, okay, put this in your computer and it'll do the rest for you.
Right, right.
So at the same time, I couldn't give a Windows disk to my grandma and say,
yeah, but to an extent, you could. I mean, it comes with enough shitty basic software and stuff that, right?
Well, I mean, in getting them, getting her to install it.
Well, no, even completely removing the install procedure from it, I would argue that on both Vista and XP, which are still very predominant in my work, because, let's face it, XP works well enough for a whole lot of people, if they ever have to reinstall, God forbid they try and get a codec pack, because you search for codec pack on Google, and your first page is going to be full of malware already.
Well, and I've definitely had that experience, too. I mean, with Windows, trying to play an HD video of any kind, it's just a giant pain in the dick. I mean, you've got to install, Jake, what's that thing that you've got to install on Windows to get HD video to play with 1080p's?
Okay,
I use the CCCP.
Well, yeah, that works great. The Comey
Combined Community Codec pack?
No, the Comey Codec.
Yeah, the one with the anime girl that shows up and...
But, Jake, you got to do something, right? What is that? You got to fuck with your DirectX?
Oh, yeah, that's... it's actually a commercial program. It's called CoreAVC.
Yeah, yeah.
And what it does is it offloads some of the processing. They have some sort of algorithm that lets you play 1080p video or even 720p video, whatever it is, whatever how many P's you have, it's going to play on a processor that's lower than about 2.4 gigahertz.
Well, I have more P's than you.
But that technology isn't just exclusive to CoreAVC either. What is that technology that NVIDIA has? Specifically
Pure
for Linux.
Video or something, or Pure Video HD?
There's a... And I can't remember for the life of me what it's called now, but essentially it does the same thing on Linux. And they've had benchmarks.
VDPA,
yeah. They've had benchmarks where it'll run on a ridiculously old Celeron processor, and you'll get 1080p with 20% CPU usage. So it does exist.
But here's the thing. The point I was trying to make is that in order to get a good 1080p movie working on my box here under Windows Vista, I had to install that CoreAVC program and screw around with all my settings and everything. Meanwhile, I could play the same movie on my shitty laptop with half the power in VLC under Debian with no dicking around. It just worked. I mean, there's something up with the Windows video stack that just doesn't work.
The other interesting thing is the latest 1.1.0 release of VLC does support hardware offloading, but not under ATI on Windows. There's this big thing that the developers have gone ATI, same old situation, shitty drivers, they're not developer friendly, whatever their big grief complaints are. It sounds
like the normal ATI deal. That's pretty much just what you get when you sign up
for
ATI.
But for NVIDIA, it's okay?
For NVIDIA on Windows, it works fine. I'm not sure what the deal on
They're using
Linux
that same API for the hardware acceleration, and the only reason it doesn't work on ATI is because ATI came up with a competing version of it rather than adopting it as a standard.
Oh, of course.
And so there's a big rush in the open source community, and I only know this because we're using an ATI card as our home theater system, or in our home theater system, and there's a big rush in the open source community to try and make an adapter that works, you know, so one API layer that'll then translate to both hardware.
But see, that seems like a genius idea. I don't know why the hardware makers didn't do that like fucking years ago. Because that just, if you only had to write drivers exactly once and it worked everywhere, how awesome would that be?
I don't disagree.
So Dana, what are you doing with Linux lately?
Unfortunately, my Linux use has really become limited. I tried out Linux Mint 9 for a while on my laptop, dual booting with Windows 7 Pro.
Right.
And I just found that with how little I actually use my laptop, I really wasn't using Linux at all.
Really?
If I had more time, I would have played around with it. But for just using, you know, my laptop quickly or for anything, I was just booting into Windows more often than I was booting into Linux. From the little experience I had, Linux Mint 9 Isadora was fantastic.
Yeah, that's what I'm using right now, and it's beautiful.
Beautiful, easy to use, everything worked perfectly.
The buttons are on
the
correct side of the title bar.
Yes.
Yeah, we're talking to you there, Ubuntu. What the fuck is that shit?
And furthermore, regardless of whether, not that I want to start this whole rant, but...
Yes, you do.
Okay, fine, we'll go down that road momentarily. If you're going to change the buttons, at least give a tool that changes them back for any theme. Don't make it theme dependent for one, and don't make people learn gconf to do it otherwise for two.
How about at least give a reasonable explanation of why you did it and some kind of justification for it, not just because it looks like a Mac. I mean, like, come on. Like,
but
honestly.
John, it looks like a Mac.
Yeah, but that's fucking bullshit. I mean, let's have a usability reasoning for it. You know what I mean?
I mean, allegedly there was some sort of hiring of a UI or UX consultant
for the project.
I don't think it was explained in a satisfactory manner to anyone outside Canonical.
Yeah, that's where I would stand on the matter as well.
So if I'm continuing here.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
I'm just sitting here looking at porn. No.
I love porn.
Yeah, so my desktop Linux use is zero right now. Now, as I was at the beginning of the Linux experiment and continuing now, I am still using Linux in general on my HTC Magic, sorry, the Magic Plus, because Rogers decided to add the Sense UI to it, on my HTC Magic phone, or as any listeners in the States might know it, as the MyTouch 3G, I believe it's called.
Is that what it's called in the States?
Yeah. Now, unfortunately, Rogers have been dicks. Yes, Rogers, if anybody from Rogers is listening...
You know what, if anyone from Rogers is listening, fuck yourself.
Please just fuck yourself.
Honestly, go and die and desecrate the grave of Rogers Sr.
In a
honestly.
dirty house fire.
Yeah, honestly.
We digress. The reason I launched into that rant is because even though my phone has been out on Rogers since, last June 6th, which is when it released, I am still stuck on Android 1.5. Now, as of, I believe it was January that I got this message, there was a bug fix in Android 1.5 that was released where if you had GPS enabled, you were unable to complete 911 calls. Now, Rogers, of course, you know, very concerned about this, immediately released a fix to this as soon as they heard about it. Now, the trouble with that is the dev community had closed this bug 6 months earlier. Rogers was so far behind. They also, you know, because they're fun, cut off my data until I flashed this fix. Now, the trouble with that as well, once I flashed this fix, Rogers has gone ahead and put on what is known as a perfected SPL or bootloader on my phone, 1.76.0010. If anybody out there knows how to crack it, please God help me.
You know what, that brings up a bit of a conversation that we were having a little just before the podcast. Please. And we were talking about the state of mobile phone software in the days of software that's competitive to a regular OS on these smartphones. I mean, is it kosher for these carriers to be holding back releases and releasing them on their own schedule, or should people be able to get their fucking phone upgrades when they want them? I mean,
The latter, absolutely. There is absolutely no reason I shouldn't be able to flash Android 2.1 to my phone immediately. The only reason my phone isn't actually Google branded is because when it released the phone, Rogers added Microsoft Exchange support, which has since been added to Android since 1.6.
Right. Now, is that the fault of Google for not keeping a tighter rein on their phone in an Apple-esque fashion, or is that the fault of...
I think it's more of a branding type thing, or it was at the time. Google wasn't necessarily sure if they were going to support Exchange during that OS release,
right.
And they wouldn't give their golden seal of approval or whatever it was for phones that threw this support in. And I mean, you almost might have expected to see something like that with a lot of the HTC hardware that's out
right.
there, where they put their Sense UI or whatever it is on the devices. You figure Google would have something to say about that if they're either overloading or overwriting the stock apps on there. I don't know. I come from a fairly different perspective in my professional life that I will endeavor not to talk about because it'll probably get me in trouble on this.
Lawsuit.
Carriers will certify operating system releases for their devices, and over the life of the device, there might be 1,000 point upgrades, like 0.001, 0.002, 0.003.
Right.
These releases get sent to the carriers.
That's only 999.
Yeah.
Oh, snap.
It goes up to 1,001.
Get a brain, Morans.
But please continue.
In any event, the carriers gateway
shut up.
These releases, and they do it for several good reasons. One is that the carriers are responsible for the first-line tech support. So if they get you calling in, and chances are if you're calling into the carrier's tech support, you're a consumer, and you're a consumer in the lowest sense of the word.
Well, absolutely.
You might not know how to compose a text message on your brand new Apple
iPhone 4.
Okay,
exactly.
But this is the exact problem I have with this line of thinking from the carriers. It's that it shouldn't matter. The carrier shouldn't be your first line of defense. If you have a different... Okay, take Android as an example. HTC puts out their own version of it.
Right.
Motorola puts out their own version of it. Google puts out their own version of it. They're all essentially the same operating system at the end of the day, but they have little inconsistencies. You know, the Sense UI or whatever that other one is. The Blur. Motorola Blur. But shouldn't Motorola, shouldn't HTC, shouldn't Google be the first line of defense for tech support? Shouldn't the carriers just say, okay, listen, if it's not a direct problem with us, and we'll know if it's a direct problem with us because you'll have worked your way through the support channel other and to us, go to whoever came up with the operating system software and talk to them.
Yeah, but see, this is, again, this is an issue of sovereignty for the carriers.
Oh, absolutely.
Though, because the carriers don't want to give up that power. It's the same reason the carriers don't want to become dumb data pipes and resisted really, really good data on phones for a long time because they like their walled-in gardens where they can make an extra couple of bucks, right?
Yeah, but the carriers could still limit what they allow on their network while still... off,
but wouldn't that be the same approval
cost.
Process because they'd only allow certain builds of the OS? I mean,
no, we're talking standardized technologies here. We're talking, you know, CDMA or vice versa. You know, like
okay, so yeah, but the software running on the phone itself would be wide open as long as it was a recognized.
The
version
UI that you get on your phone to send a text message might differ from the UI on my phone, but regardless of how it looks on our phones, the technology behind it is still probably going to be standards compliant.
Okay.
If it's not standards compliant, it won't be sold through the carrier.
Right.
Once it's on the carrier, though, it shouldn't matter. It should go straight to whoever created the software. That's my thought.
The issue is, though, a lot of those companies are not set up to deal with support volumes of that level.
Yeah.
I mean, try calling Google for tech support.
Look
it's
what happened with
happen.
The look what happened
you
with support for the
Google.
Nexus One.
But maybe that's
does Google
the
even have a phone
no,
number?
No, Google doesn't have a phone number. You
unless
can't
you
call
their
Google.
Corporate counsel.
It's Google voice number based in Indonesia.
Google does actually have a support line, but it's mostly through email conversations that they'll handle your support.
Yeah. So now,
and they're going to have to build it up anyways with Chrome OS.
Well,
so,
I guess you're right.
Not even necessarily. They could offload that support to the laptop manufacturers. I know there's a very good reason for people or for these carriers to handle the first-line tech support is because they will get preferential treatment from the device manufacturer the more support requests they handle. And that is a monetary thing. That's in the contract. And I know that applies very much so for what we do. So, in effect, the less traffic that you send to the device manufacturer,
the less you're going to end up having to pay them in the long run. And that's what the carriers like.
And the less people who commit suicide at the device manufacturer. The...
Oh, that was terrible.
That was really bad taste, Dana. I just look at you know it. What? You're an asshole.
I just look at smartphones now, like the PC market.
Well, shit,
you know?
Yeah.
So the phones are so... All right, we have phones that have 1 gigahertz processors, 512 megs of RAM.
May I just take a minute to say that's absurd?
OpenGL 3.0 capable graphics cards.
Next year they're looking at releasing dual core. Two gigahertz chips for phones.
That's just ridiculous.
Yeah. So we're well beyond the point where, you know, these aren't little, you know, phone. They're not even phones anymore. They're computing devices that happen to be able to make a phone call.
Yeah,
so
sure.
Let's move on. You know, let's. And I know the carriers are slow to move, but seriously.
At the same time, let's move on and just do, like, voice over data at all times, honestly. Why should I have to have minutes and a data plan? That's ridiculous.
I completely agree. Like, yeah. I've been testing that on my Nexus One, or I was, where it was hooking up directly to our Asterisk server over the data plan. And it worked well over wireless, and it would work well over 3G, but it just wasn't. It doesn't work over Edge. Well, you have to be on 3G.
If you were to do like a Skype-like service, right, for this, and you could encode the audio in like speaks, and yep. It really wouldn't hurt your data plan at all.
Works well.
I mean, what the hell?
Well, and from my personal experience, I have used Skype over 3G, and it does work, but it also... It's not very consistent either.
Okay.
So like you've noticed with tethering your phone, there's an initial burst of data speed, but then it trickles down.
Right.
And that doesn't bode well for having a lengthy conversation. So.
Well, the other thing is it'll try and determine the bandwidth for, say, things in the future like video calling. And I say in the future because really video calling is not there, and the only people that are trying to get it right now are Apple.
Well, they're only trying to get it right on Wi-Fi connections.
Yeah, but that'll change.
Well, not if they stick with AT&T. As far, I mean, I'm not an American, but I listen to enough podcasts to know that apparently AT&T is just balls. So you know, it can't be any
worse
than
Rogers. This podcast is not brought to you by AT&T
or Rogers
or anyone.
Rogers, AT&T. You know what? We should start out. You know what? Tech savvy should have a carrier because I'm not getting.
Oh my God!
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
They already have VoIP.
Listen, I'm not paid by Tech Savvy in any way, shape, or form, but I am a loyal customer. They
make me hot.
The best by far. If you don't fucking buy your internet from Tech Savvy, change your ways, you heathen sinner.
This advertisement brought to you by LinuxExperiment.com.
Hey, if anyone from TechSavvy is listening, call us up. We'd like some of your money.
No, here's what needs to happen. If anyone from TechSavvy is listening, bring your internet over cable to Waterloo.
Agreed.
It's like $46 a month. You bring your own modem, and there's no data cap on it, and it's 10-1.
That's how the internet should work. TechSavvy, and if you ever called their support line, holy shit.
Yeah, they are nice.
As
yeah.
opposed to calling Roger's support line
well,
and being on
it's
hold
It's because TechSavvy
is
based
hours.
In Chatham. Thanks.
Okay, so Dave, what have you been doing with Linux since you haven't been fucking posting? You've had plenty of time, right?
I did do a post last
Neither
week.
Neither have I.
Yeah, your third.
Fourth post.
Well, at least Dana posted once upon a time. I mean,
yeah,
the experiment is over. I can't hold him to that, but shit, man.
Experiment is never over.
We're always experimenting.
Well, everyone in here will pretty much be experimenting with Linux or some type of open source software.
I can post about my phone.
Yeah, you could. Yeah.
Well, look, Android's Linux, right? Yeah. Same shit. Okay, so Dave, what have you been up to?
So recently,
Before you start, you made a claim earlier this afternoon that I'd like you to explore, perhaps.
Yeah, I was enraged. I had installed Linux Mint on a box this morning. And it was slow as balls.
Slow? What were the specs of the box?
How slow are balls?
Pentium 4 1.7 with 512
My balls
mega
are faster
RAM.
Than your balls.
Onboard Intel video or something. It's like an 800 series.
So it's probably swapping right out of the gate.
The other computer.
Oh, the other one. I'm not sure what that one is. It's
probably
like,
similar.
You know what, though? It doesn't matter because it doesn't surprise me. Even on my laptop here, Linux Mint regularly takes up almost a gig of RAM.
Okay,
after
but, no, but like, how much RAM did you have, though, Dave?
I think 512.
So you're figuring Linux Mint was swapping, Tyler?
Well, it scales down like... I made a post a while back showing how all these distros handle on, you know, lower amounts of RAM, and they do really scale down.
If you haven't seen that post, come read our post.
But Linux in general, the memory usage, it takes up a lot of RAM, but it's just because it doesn't free a lot of it.
No, but it doesn't use the page file though. Windows uses the page file like it's going out of style, like
it's not necessarily a bad thing that Linux is using up so much RAM.
I mean, you've got all the RAM. Yeah. May as well fucking use it, right?
But it, like, if you have less RAM, then it'll use less RAM, obviously, but it shouldn't really affect performance to that extent.
In my experience, and this is, again, with what I installed at my dad's office there, he's running a machine that's, you know, an Intel integrated 512 megs of system memory, so it is taxed already. And on Windows, it was, you know, slow as can be. Even after reinstalling Windows on their Windows XP, once you get all the updates on it, it's just so slow. And while, you know, Linux isn't, you know, known for speed in general, you know, when you start an application or whatever, it is still significantly faster than XP is with all the updates.
XP on that same
machine.
Die.
So
what did you run on that machine for a distro?
I don't know, man. XP was pretty solid.
It
was.
Ubuntu 9.10.
Yeah, I might have to try that. Well, that one, so I was like, you know what, forget this. Not going to use this computer. So I move over to this other computer that Jake had given me a while ago to put a server up there. And it died after I installed Linux Mint.
Yeah, like, I wouldn't doubt if the hard drive in there is an IBM Death Star.
It just kept shutting down.
What we can learn from this is that your hardware sucks and it's not Linux's fault, or...
And my T60 died last week, so I've just been having...
Okay, so it's just you then.
For the 10 minutes today...
So what's Dave been up to? Fucking up computers.
For the 10 minutes today that I was using Linux Mint...
Dave, don't touch my computer.
I was using Linux Mint for about 10 minutes today, and I liked it. Although, what I couldn't figure out, and maybe you guys can answer this, I tried to install Miro through the software manager, and it didn't show up anywhere.
What do you mean?
Like, it didn't show up in the applications list.
Applications, sound, and video.
Yeah, it didn't show up there.
Okay, we'll try doing it through Synaptic. Synaptic's great.
I'll have to do that.
It really didn't show up?
It really didn't show up.
I just got a message from Phil, by the way, asking how the podcast is going.
What's
so.
That asshat up to?
He's not here. He's not doing.
He's wanking.
What a jerk, Phil. Okay, well, you know, speaking of Miro, even though your install didn't work, I've never had that problem.
I'm going to try it right now just to see.
I have problems like that with TweetDeck. Do it through the software manager.
I will.
But look at Miro is, if you don't use that, fucking use it because it's the greatest app in the whole world. You can get free audio and free TV, and they have like a listing. The only complaint, what is that error message, Tyler, with Miro? It's like you can't use the search utility on their Miro audio guide.
There's two problems with Miro that still exist. For one, it's made by German developers, which isn't, you know, a dig against it, but you'll see what I mean in a second. When you install it,
it's too efficient and full of shies of porn.
And I won't make the other... Anyways. Yeah. When you first start it up, it prompts you to scan in media. Or at least I assume it does, because I can't read the dialogue because it's in fucking German.
That's right. That's a localization
issue. Once you just hit the button, though, I don't know what the button says, something German. Once you hit the button, it launches the application in full English, and from that point forward, it's in full English. Yeah. So how the fuck did they miss that? Seriously.
Yeah, the startup thing. Well,
I didn't have that issue when I installed it for Mac.
And as far as I can recall, you know, as long as I can recall, it's always had that problem. So how have they not fixed that bug? It seems like it's a simple if statement to me, but, you know, what do I know?
Well,
anyways, the other issue is that in the Miro video guide, which is awesome.
It's incredible.
They have a search box, which is fine because it's just an embedded web browser. But when you go to try and search on that in Linux, it won't let you, because searching in the Miro guide in the web browser in Linux is not supported.
Which is ridiculous, because it's not like Flash or anything. It's just a web browser. I mean, we got plenty of web browsers that work just fine on Linux, so... What the fuck? But outside of those two issues, Miro is incredible. I use it. We use it at home in our entertainment center for getting all kinds of great free media from Twit and from Revision 3 and shit like that. And I use it at work for audio podcasts as well, because its RSS support is just wicked. So
I can also confirm that Dave is not lying. Miro does not show up in the application.
Is that just on Mint?
Yeah, and
just on Mint.
Because we've got it on Ubuntu 10.04 on our media server, and it works fine.
Let me see if I can launch it from the command line.
That's weird.
Maybe it's like...
This makes me want to reinstall Linux Mint.
Linux Mint is awesome, man. It really is.
See what I mean about the German here?
Okay, so there is German there. What is
Dude,
it?
How do you not understand that? Willkommen zur Miro Ersteinrichtung. Die Nachsten Blitzschirme Scheiße Porn werden.
Du hast Achtung, alles Lookins Peepers. Das Computer Machine ist nicht für Gefingerpoken und Mitten graben.
Oh, but they fixed half of it, because when you hit the German button, it comes in and gives you. It's got a title. That's in English, even though the rest of it is
Completing
in German.
Completing the Miro first time setup, the rest of it's in German, and then there's a no in the S.
Mind you, it's English, but at least it's somewhat there.
Yeah, but I mean, after that, it works great. But I mean, VLC is from France, and they do a pretty good job. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's their GUI is balls, but at least they translate, so, you know. Anyway, Jake, what have you been doing?
Well, lately, I have been... mostly running two machines at my home. The first one is MacBook Pro. I got a new laptop. I decided to continue with Steve-O's Machine of Wonder. And that's been suiting me really well. I mean, I really enjoy the UI. I really enjoy the operating system. The fact that it can pull up a terminal and do everything I need to and still have all that fruity stuff in there.
Now, I've never used Apple stuff. I just don't. I've never actually used it. So, well, what's the terminal like on a Mac? Is it comparable to Linux? Is it useful?
Yeah,
it's
basically the same thing.
Do they have a package manager
of any
kind?
The file system for an OS X machine is almost identical to a Linux machine.
It's Unix-based.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, BSD, I guess,
so
technically.
So, it is a little bizarre, though, at times. Like,
it is. Like, I mean, if you wanted to F-disk something, you're probably better
I'll give you an
not
example.
Doing that.
In the time that I spent using it, I couldn't find, and maybe this is just me being a moron, but I couldn't find...
Get a brain, morons.
In, what is that thing called? The equivalent of Windows Explorer.
Finder.
In Finder, how you can get to the root file system. The root of the file system. I just don't know. I didn't see anywhere in there to do so.
It's just the actual computer icon, and there is a go-to option in the menu where you can just go to slash
hard drive.
Yeah, but see,
a lot of the folders are hidden.
Yeah, that's true. If you just go to Macintosh HD,
you're not
going to
see like
shown,
USR,
right?
Like,
they don't show
like
var.
That.
Yeah, they don't show private, which is their equivalent of a localized Etsy folder. Things like that. I mean, it is certainly a little bit different, but it's certainly not too hard to navigate the file system.
I would say, if you're going to compare it to Linux, it's Linux Lite, essentially.
Right.
Because, yeah, it does let you do some things. Not all the commands are there. It's close, but if you really are a terminal junkie, I don't think you're going to get all your jollies out of it.
But the graphical tools in the Mac, they'll make up for it, right? Because in my experience, if you're
it's
doing anything hard on Linux,
system.
If you're doing anything tough on Linux, you don't want to use the graphical tools. They're terrible.
No, Mac is obviously a desktop operating system. It is not by any means a server operating system.
Well, I mean,
and even OS X server, I mean, you would get that on whatever you have. So your X server, your Mac Mini that's designed to be your OS X server. And it all comes pre-configured, it all comes set up. And the GUI tools for that end of server management are actually pretty neat. Now, I haven't played around with any of the recent ones, but they've done a pretty good job, and it all just interfaces with the existing tools. So web sharing is actually Apache.
Right.
And mail server is actually Postfix or Dovecot or whatever they're using in the background now for an email server.
That must make it pretty easy from their point of view to assemble a software stack.
Yes, essentially. All the base part of the system, before you get into Aqua, which is their user interface, is from other folks.
Right.
And it generally tends to work pretty well. Like, I don't know. I like it well enough as a desktop machine, and it's got enough of the terminal that I can use it. So if I do need to do a batch operation on a directory, if I do need to remove all .svn folders in a particular project so that I can copy it somewhere else without recursing five levels deep.
You've never heard of the export tool?
I've done that
a number
of times.
No, but this is, let's say you've gotten a repository off of someone else, and it's not actually connected to the original one, and you've got these stupid hidden .svn files, and you do want to move it somewhere else.
Export will do that.
It doesn't exactly do what... you want.
Okay, but even in Windows...
So you're taking a repo and you want to convert the repo into a standard folder structure.
You know what?
And
you know
it has no connection whatsoever to the original
repository. Yes, no .svn file folders, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what export does.
I'm aware of what export does. It's not the same thing.
Okay.
It really isn't.
You know, you know what you shouldn't do in that situation? Is you shouldn't take two folders that have similar SVN structures and copy one folder like into another when you're in the trunk of a working directory at work and then leave for the day and then have other people try and use that directory.
yeah, that would certainly be unpleasant.
Oh man, I made a huge mess. That was like my first week on the job. I just fucked everything up. So yeah, that was not good.
Mm-hmm. But, okay, so Mac is my primary system, but up until recently, like as in 2 days ago, I was running a desktop with, Mint 9 on it, and that's been suiting me pretty well. However, I decided I'd flatten and reinstall and put a copy of 7 back on because of Steam. I want to play my games, and Steam for Linux isn't there yet, and even when it's there... it'll just play the couple of games that are going to be compatible with it.
That's right.
I mean, I have Steam for Mac now. It's been working brilliantly for the games that are on there, and I've been buying stuff from the sale looking specifically for things that are going to work on both the Mac and the PC.
I actually haven't tried Steam on Linux yet. I
Well, there is no Steam for Linux yet.
Well, I've had it installed in Wine. Is that what you're doing? Or?
Okay. I've never been able to actually get it to work to my satisfaction.
Well, I got Steam to work in Wine, but I didn't get anything else to work in Wine. There were no games or anything.
But I mean, I want to play something that I bought for $5, like Knights of the Old Republic.
Ooh, or like World of Goo.
Yeah, World of Goo actually does have a Linux port, apparently.
Yes, I know it does. But I already own it on Steam. So, I'd willingly give them another $20, though. That is a fucking awesome game.
Mm-hmm.
There's another endorsement. Buy World of Goo right now.
I have it. It kicks ass.
Yeah, it's great.
It rapes my face.
By the way, it also plays beautifully on Linux. So, for anyone listening to this podcast, you should download World of Goo.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, it's very, very well designed. I mean, all props to the developers on that.
I've got a similar situation as you do, though, with Steam games, but I've got actually a partition on this machine that's an XP partition, and all it exists for is for Steam.
It's for Steam,
That's pretty much it. I really, really hope that Steam gets around to doing a Linux version and that they port... See, I don't think they'll port any of the old games, but that they start a trend.
No, probably not. But anything using the Source engine will probably get there.
This is my hope, is that Valve releases a Steam client for Linux, ports the Source engine for Linux, and then demonstrates that there's actually money to be made, and that neckbeards will actually purchase games on Linux. Because if they do, I wouldn't need Windows. I could do Linux all the time.
The results of that, that donation...
The Humble Indie Bundle, are you
referring
to?
Yeah, there was one. That was that one, and then the other one. What was that called?
Oh, yeah, another one of those. I'm not sure. I might have actually bought, whatever it was. I might have actually contributed a donation to there. It's just, I haven't really gotten around to installing it. My time has been occupied with Civ 4 and on the 360 Red Dead Redemption, which I've... beaten the main campaign, and now I really don't know if I have the ambition to go and do the rest of the stuff in it.
Regardless, what I was trying to get at there was that they looked at the average amount of money donated based on the three platforms, Windows, Linux, Linux, and Macintosh, and they found that I think it was something like Linux people on average donated $15 per game. Mac people donated $9, and Windows people donated like $3 or something, right? And then they did the numbers, to compensate for the market share that each platform has.
Right.
And they found that on Linux, you're five times more likely five times more likely as a Linux user to pay double the amount of money when compared to a Windows user for the same game. So it's not that there isn't money to be made; it's that they just have to, maybe these small little, shovelware titles aren't going to make it on Linux when they might be able to get a pass on Windows just because of sheer numbers. But when you're talking about mainstream titles, for sure there's enough money to be made on Linux.
Now, you have to wonder, though, that if a reaction like that and a survey like that is not slightly biased and just from the sheer happenstance that gaming on Linux, while it exists, is not very good. I mean, I'm sorry to anybody listening, but frankly, it's just not there. There are a couple of titles that are all right. They're getting there, but it's not anywhere near what you can get on Windows or even on the Mac. So when you do get a great game that plays well and is smooth and whatever, that people are, you know, rushing to buy.
I mean, I would certainly be inclined to pay for that.
But shouldn't that be like a Yukon Gold Rush for game developers? Like there's this untapped market that they haven't seen yet that's willing to spend more money for the same game. Shouldn't
we need like an app store. Wait, we have repositories. Oh, shit.
The apt store?
The apt, apt store. Oh,
that's terrible. That's
you should patent that. And
or
make
you should
it
kill yourself thinking
one or the other,
that's,
really.
That's an option.
Do you really have a choice? All right, so Jake, what else have you been doing? Basically just the
there is a there's a silver lining to said cloud of me deciding to install Win 7 again at home is that at work corporate standard is currently XP.
Right.
So I run an XP box. There are quite a few people that use Linux as their main system, but they always have to run a VM with Outlook in it because as of yet, there is no acceptable Outlook client for Linux. And even the people that are running MacBook Pros or MacBooks there, there's a fairly large contingent inside there as well that running Entourage, which is the equivalent of Outlook on the Mac right now, even that's acceptable to them. It's just the corporate standard is Active Directory and Outlook. And I've found it's a very powerful tool, certainly, but when you don't have Outlook web access enabled, you are immediately stuck, and it's disabled for many and numerous security reasons.
You know,
I mean, as soon as you start exposing your email on the web like that, it's just, it's another potential breach point.
Right.
So they don't even want to run it internally, and I can understand that, but the end result is I either have to run a VM that is not technically supported by anyone, or I can run Windows and do Linux in a VM, which is what I've chosen to do. So I am running Mint 9 in a VM, just mainly for the Linux tool stack, grep and find and GCC and things like that. And it's been great. It's really been excellent. It's interfaced with all the corporate systems that I've needed to connect to. It will do mapping of domain shares and things like that without a huge problem. So in that context, I've been really impressed with it, and I hope to be able to continue using it. And it's really nice that it's Debian-based at its core, so I have all those tools. I can add repositories if I do need to install some obscure or Debian-specific piece of software.
Right, right. I also use Linux at work. I use Ubuntu 9.10, I guess, at work, and it's good. It was just what was installed when I got it. I wanted to change to Fedora, but I haven't had a chance. But as a web developer, which is what I do at work, it's, you know, Linux is just fucking sick. It's great. I mean, you got your terminal, you got your SCP, all your command lines that you use all the time to interact with servers. You know, SSH is right there instead of having to call up PuTTY and then put in your stuff. You know what I mean? It's like it's tweaked for web development. It works great.
Yeah. What do you mostly use for your web development IDE?
Oh, IDE. God, don't ask me. I use fucking Zen Studio, which is built on top of Eclipse, and it's a piece of shit. It's,
you know what else is built on top of Eclipse and is a piece of shit? Lotus
Notes.
Lotus
Notes.
Basically,
Lotus Scrotes?
Eclipse should die in a fire. They need to just... Eclipse for Java? For Java.
Eclipse? This is how I look at it, okay? Eclipse is an excellent and flexible and capable platform. It does not mean that you should make an email client on top of there or any sort of, you know, should be lightning fast, responsive, low memory usage, you know, program.
Speaking of low memory usage, so I opened up Task Manager on my work PC today after not having closed Lotus Notes for about a week. So the notes, first off, the JVM in itself was taking up 570 megs of RAM.
Jesus.
Then the notes process was taking up another 200. And then on top of that, in our environment, we use Symantec Corporate.
Right.
Symantec Corporate 10. And that was taking up another, 180? So, two programs there, email and antivirus, and I've got a gig of RAM.
That God. Is absurd. Honestly, now, I can't. You can't justify that.
Like, what sort of horrible memory leak does Lotus Notes have that would allow it Furthermore, to float so badly?
We link it all in with Domino as the background, right? Our back end. So we have a bunch of databases that we use on a daily basis.
On unstable app servers.
And I have one in particular that just really shows me how terrible this program is on a daily basis. And it's that when you click to see it, it refreshes the view, and it says, you know, refreshing view, this may take a while. No shit, it takes, like, minutes. And you may use other tabs in Lotus Notes while this is happening.
But it locks them.
Bullshit, you can. Exactly. It locks it. And you can't, the UI does not refresh because, in my personal experience, I know that Java does not allow a direct refresh, you know, under most circumstances, and I'm sure the IBM guys using standard programming practices don't try and push it.
Oh, yeah, along with the fuck you to Rogers. If anybody from IBM is listening, fuck you too.
Well, it was interesting. I mean, I did spend about 18 months there during some of my co-op terms, and it was all Lotus Notes internally as well. And the biggest thing that I heard when people were being acquired by the company, at least in the software division, is, well, that's our biggest stumbling block. We don't want to use Lotus Notes.
Well, can you blame them?
I don't know. I never really had a huge issue with it. I saw it as part of my tool set. I saw it as part of what we did dogfooding the existing product. And it really didn't bother me because, hey, let's face it, you're sending an email. You have to wait for it. It happens.
Well,
it shouldn't.
I've never used Lotus Notes. I've never worked at a company that uses it. But I have used this Zen Studio, and it's got a lot of similar issues. You know, it just doesn't fucking work. You know, like when we use Zen Studio at work, it's where to begin? Okay, it's slow. It's a memory hog. It has text like formatting and syntax highlighting, but only for PHP. if you do it sometimes for HTML, it works. For JavaScript, which, I mean, we've had JavaScript now for, like, what, 15 fucking years? It doesn't matter if your JavaScript is in line with your HTML or if it's a separate JavaScript file. It'll just, like, stop highlighting the JavaScript correctly at a certain character and then continue, like, 200 fucking lines down and just do it well. You know what I mean? It's terrible. It's full of bugs. The IntelliSense doesn't work worth a shit. Meanwhile, I picked up at home for doing web dev at home because I'm such a fucking nerd that I do web dev at home and at work. I picked up an open source project called Genie. That's G-E-A-N-Y that works for Windows and Linux, and it's the greatest thing since sliced bread and selling faster than hotcakes. And, you know, it's like, it's the shit. It's okay. Got full IntelliSense on every language. It pulls in JavaScript files or PHP files that you've included and does the full IntelliSense on them. It's got syntax highlighting and code formatting. It really is amazing. It's a fantastic app. It's the way that Zend should work. And here's the kicker. Genie is free, and Zend costs $700 per developer per month.
Per month?
Yes.
That's...
No, I apologize. Per year. Hold on. Okay. Yeah. Sorry.
still, per year?
That's fucking absurd, though. I mean, come on. Think about that. $700 per developer per year, and it doesn't work. It's a piece of shit. So, yeah. You know what? Fuck Eclipse. Unless you're doing Java, and then maybe it's okay.
But I have to, you know, okay. And don't get me wrong, Eclipse is by far the best Java IDE in existence.
That just means that there's no other good ones.
But that's my point. You would think that it wouldn't be that hard to make a good Java IDE that doesn't exist, that isn't made in Java. And I know that's the big thing, you know, write the IDE in the language that you're programming for. But when the IDE itself takes up over 100 megs on a dev
environment...
That's
just nerd cred, though.
But you know what I mean? Like, I want to see what my application can do. I don't want to be constrained by the fact that the IDE is getting in my way now. And it's not like in your way that, you know, as you're developing, it's just in your way on a system resource level, which is not at all good.
No, I agree with you entirely. I find that anything built on Eclipse just gets in my way. That's just... Anyway, as far as, you know, Lotus Notes sucking goes, you should just use Thunderbird 3. I know that's probably not like corporate policy, but it's the best email client.
Doesn't support Domino.
It's the best email client ever made. What are you talking about? It's the best email client ever made. What are you talking about?
Yeah, but it doesn't support Domino.
But have you tried searching with it? Come on, it's got graphs and shit. The search
is amazing.
It's fucking graphs and shit.
How does the search compare to something like Gmail?
Oh, dude, the search blows is so out good. Of the water.
You can, okay, when you search, it shows you keywords. It shows you all the email it found. It shows you a percentage graph. It shows you, you can drill it down by date, by subject, by sender, by body, you know, by relevance. By email
address, yeah.
By email address.
By date.
And then every time you adjust it, it does the whole thing again. And it really is, you know, it may not be the perfect search, but at the very least, it gives you the tools that are needed or necessary to get you exactly what you want.
And it gives you this graph, too, of how many, and this is just totally unnecessary, but it does it anyway. It gives you this graph of how many emails you got from how many people, like by date. It's just, it really is mind blowing. It's an awesome, awesome tool. Hey, can you guys stop sucking each other's dicks over there? And
I'm sorry, just one sec.
Sorry, we're just reveling in the greatness that is our site.
Oh, I see. Our site is awesome. It's true. Everybody, if you haven't been to thelinksexperiment.com...
I don't know how you're getting this if you haven't been there.
No, it makes graphs and shit.
Is this listed in like the iTunes directory?
It's
maybe?
Listed in iTunes. And it's listed we are
the
alley.
First hit on Yahoo, Bing, and Google now. So if you look for the Linux Experiment and have your head out of your own ass,
you'll probably find us. We exist. It's true. We're kind of big shit, you know.
if I could,
kind of a big deal.
Randomly, just thought of something. I was just firing off a text message on my phone. Is it porn? It might be porn. But I was just firing off a text message on my phone, and just one little fun thing I wanted to talk about. It's not Linux specific. It is just sort of touch screen specific. It's a fantastic application called Swipe. And if you haven't,
I've heard about Swipe.
It is, oh my god, wonderful. Yes, very recently. It is so good and makes me wet. It is so good.
Okay, now, listen, I'm sure they'll use that as their marketing piece.
Swipe, it'll make you wet.
I love my hardware BlackBerry keyboard. And iPhone, annoying-ass iPhone users like Tyler keep telling me that that's just because I've never used the software keyboard.
It's true. I was worried for the longest time.
You know
what,
though? Fuck it. I love my hardware keyboard. And I am seriously considering checking out the new BlackBerry OS 6 when it releases and giving it the time of day. Listen, RIM has passed. Honestly, they're not on top of the pile anymore. They're not making the phones that everybody wants anymore. But I am willing to check out OS 6 for two reasons. One, they fixed the browser. And two, they've still got that fucking sweet hardware keyboard. I love RIM. I love their phones.
I mean, I and a lot of other people would also say that we like our hardware keyboards. It's very nice. It's very nice to have. It's the fastest keyboard I've ever used. I've used an N1. I've used an iPhone for about a month. I could not get used to the soft keys.
I've only used the iPhone for, you know, like 5-minute stretches, but I find it just doesn't. The first time I got my BlackBerry, right, I was coming from like a, you know, like a fucking shitty little Nokia thing, right, with the IntelliType and whatever. And at first I was trying too hard, but then I just kind of let go and just, you know, my thumbs knew where everything was and it just worked. I did not have that with an iPhone. I find it to get in my way. I'm always making mistakes. I don't know. Maybe I'm just hammy-handed. I got fat thumbs or some shit.
Well, John, we all know how old you are, so
acquire it's my grasp, arthritis,
you
know, acting
what's
up.
What's the saying? You can't teach an old dog new tricks. But no, I'd actually like to hear Dana's opinion of this, because he's gone from one Android device that had a physical keyboard to an Android device that doesn't.
It's true.
And now, when I, like you said, I am an iPhone user, and I find that the software keyboard allows me to type a lot faster than you would think. So anytime you want to square off in terms of raw texting speed, I'll be glad to try you. But from Dana's perspective, I'd like to see, you know, what he thinks about the transition between hardware and software. Keeping in mind, though, that when I tried an Android keyboard, I was much slower on it than I am on the iPhone. And that could have been because of the phone size difference, which is what my thought is. But I don't know if there's something different in the way that the algorithm works behind the scenes.
Dana, what do you think?
Honestly, I was pretty reluctant to go away from the hardware keyboard, sort of like you, John. I actually, when I got my Magic, which is touchscreen only, I rarely used the QWERTY keyboard. I was using T9 almost constantly, and that's probably because I have huge fingers, too. And I just, I couldn't hit each button. Now that I moved to swipe, though, honestly, I couldn't move back to anything else. I just sort of go across to a bunch of different keys.
So does that, you just like hit the first one and then drag?
And then
the
you
others?
Just drag your finger along.
It draws
do you
a
have
line.
To like pause on each
no.
one?
No,
or is it
draws no, you can just sort of cross over it.
And then it really? Guesses what word you meant it's to pretty, say. And it's if it doesn't very know, accurate. It shows a pop-up. And yeah. like, yeah, the first time I tried it was literally, what are we at here, an hour ago. And within, you know, a minute of using it, I can see how powerful it is. It's
Samsung and Swipe together have now broken the texting, the record for fastest texting.
If it was on the iPhone, I would probably switch to it, and that's
well,
that
if I was
would
a 14-year-old girl, the fastest mm-hmm. record for texting might matter.
Yeah. If you'd like to read a more in-depth review,
you know,
you can
like
actually
the Microsoft Kin.
Ooh.
Oh, snap! If you'd like to read a more in-depth review, you can actually go over to our missing colleague Phil Downey's personal blog, which is audiophonic.com, phonic with a K.
Yeah, yeah, that's phonic with a K.
Phonic
for,
with a
for
K.
For all you cool kids.
For you cool kids with a K. And I did just do a review of Swipe, so go nuts and read, because it's awesome.
All right, sweet. That's good to hear. You know, I mean, so I guess I got to talk about how I've been using Linux lately now.
Yeah, for sure. Let's hear from John.
Before the experiment, you know what? Fuck you. Before the experiment started, I was a diehard Windows boy. I was a fanboy, basically. I'd never used anything else. Wine. I like wine.
Sure.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Later. I started Linux, and I really liked it, and so I looked for more opportunities to use it. I've now got Fedora 12. Wait, it's 12 the recent one?
13 is the
most. Yeah, okay, so
yeah.
I've got Fedora 12 on my laptop, and it's great. Honestly, I love Fedora. It is, if you're going to do, like, a development thing, what's it say?
If you people don't know, the fine folks at James Ready,
5.5,
a fine Canadian brew, have this thing where under every cap, or at least the good caps, they have a day of the year and a little, you know, text piece. And the point is to find enough bottle caps that have stuff under them that you cover the entire year's worth of dates. So this one is for April 1st, and it says, "You win a boat, asterisk." And below it says, "You did not win a boat, April Fools."
I've got one here that's for February 22nd that says, "Watch your favorite movie of all time today, Naked." For me, that
Wait,
would be...
Wait, is that a naked version of your all-time favorite movie?
No, there's a period there.
Porn
like
Star
you,
Wars.
You should be naked while watching it, which is kind of awkward because my favorite movie of all time is Gone in 60 Seconds. It's not a naked movie.
Are you
movie.
Saying you have a hard-on for...
Or are you saying, are you gone in 60 seconds?
Oh, that's what I was getting at.
My bottle cap is ghetto and has nothing.
I found one earlier that said
you should drink James Reddy.
I don't remember what day it was, but it was National Shrinkage Day, and it advised me to stay out of the water.
Well, fair enough.
Okay,
better you get the heads up.
Go out and buy James Reddy as well.
Heads up.
LinuxExperiment.com/JamesReady.
Yeah, James Reddy, if you want to pitch us some money, we'll be glad to do this anytime you want.
Because we'll throw it back James to Reddy? Your beer.
We will.
Anyway,
free James Reddy if you go to that page.
Tyler,
yo, I better go to this
page
and see if it exists first.
You better make that page right now.
If I could only spell.
Too much James Reddy.
If there is such a thing. There isn't.
So I've got, what the fuck is it? Fedora 11?
Fedora 12.
12.
I have
12. Is 13 the new one?
13 is the new one. I had 11 during the experiment.
Okay, so I've got Fedora 12 on my laptop, and you know what? It is amazing. It's got...
But I don't see cut marks all over your wrists.
Oh.
Throwing it down. No, I really, really enjoy Fedora. It's like GNOME the way GNOME should be, basically. It makes sense. Everything's logical. You can get to everything you want. It just works really, really well.
The better question, actually, at this point is, I know you guys, a lot of you, were using KDE during the experiment.
Oh, fuck
no.
That.
Oh, I'm
fuck
sorry.
KDE.
You may remember my post reviewed in podcast number 2.
Now, you know what?
No,
spiked
I know
and
both,
then prominently
I know
killed
both
our
John
traffic.
And Tyler. I know both John and Tyler had some version of KDE up and running at one point.
Tyler
was actually a huge evangelist for it, and he made me want to try it again, even though my Gentoo installation was not really conducive to the environment.
Okay, well, you know what? KDE was cool while I was using Kubuntu until I realized that Kubuntu was a piece of shit. Basically, I've gone back to GNOME full-time, and what I found is that the only reason I was using KDE was because it was kind of pretty, and if that's what you were looking for, just install Mint. Like, it's just the fact that getting Emerald and
Compass
running on anything that's not Mint is a giant pain in the dick.
All right.
But if you just install Mint, it just works.
This is actually the thing.
You don't need
KDE. I'm going to lay it down for everyone right here, right now.
Okay, let's hear it.
KDE is fine. Just like GNOME is fine. But the problem with KDE is that there isn't a KDE distribution that polishes it enough to be on par with the polished GNOME versions.
Dude, there's not a KDE distribution that polishes it enough to be on par with the lazy-ass
OpenSUSE version. OpenSUSE does a very good job until you get stuck in Yast. Okay? Fedora...
care to define or explain that?
Yast is like the package manager / god menu / system preferences /
And it's great for when you first setting up your...
I thought you said ass.
No.
It's great for when you first start to set up your computer because it's got everything in one spot. You know, great. I don't have to wait around and config files like I did in Fedora. But, yeah, the problem is, why do I have to see a big fuck-off dialog box up here every single time I want to install a piece of software that does nothing but have one single, progress bar on it? Why not, shrink that down and make it pretty? Well, the search... It doesn't matter.
It doesn't.
Point is, that's not... It's not the newest KDE, and it's not refined enough to be a good experience for a new beginner. Kubuntu is the same way. They do a good job packaging KDE... what is the newest one? 4.4 right now? As is. But unlike Ubuntu, and far removed from the likes of Linux Mint, they do not polish it. Linux Mint, it's so polished to a shine. You know what I mean? Like, there's a big difference between...
That's what she said.
There's a big difference between even Ubuntu and Linux Mint, and we went over this earlier, but there just isn't a distro that takes Kubuntu as a starting point and then takes it that one step further. And it's that one step further that you would need to really have an excellent... Did I not grab you one?
Well, I mean, especially with KDE, because with KDE, that's really what you're looking for. I mean, is that one step further, that polish that GNOME just doesn't have?
Because KDE, KDE does a lot of things good, a lot of things right. For example, unlike GNOME, you don't have to dig around in configuration files.
It's true. Or configuration menus.
My text editor isn't my options menu. You know what I mean?
It's got built-in support for graphical compositing.
Yep, it's all there. The problem is it wears on you over time because
it's 1,000 paper cuts.
In a way, Linux, for what it does it well. But when there's a problem, it gets really annoying really fast. And my experience with Linux Mint is such that those problems either don't exist or are alleviated by the fact that GNOME isn't difficult to begin with. It's very, very stripped down. It's very to a point where it's almost annoying at times, but at least it doesn't get in your way. And the same can't be said for KDE, although I am a big fan and I hope that in 4.5 and 4.6 they do finally get it to that point. They've been trying to for many versions now, but
no, I wouldn't put it on KDE because everything is there in KDE for it to be there. It's just that the fucking packagers, not the packagers, but the distros are lazy. It always seems like KDE is an afterthought. You know, Kubuntu is the afterthought of Ubuntu. Even in SUSE, which is a place where KDE should be at the forefront, Yast feels like it was written in fucking Java from a GUI standpoint. You know what I mean? They just
No, because the way that Novell approaches things is they let their teams decide what they want to do, and Yast happens to be written in GTK.
That's why it seems tacked on. You see, that's what it is, you know? It doesn't have the polish, and with something like KDE, you gotta have the polish, because that's what it's about.
But this is my problem with KDE, and I'd like to blame the distros, because it would be an easy out, but my thought
that's
is that the
I'm
distros...
Doing it.
The distro shouldn't focus on themselves because they know KDE is already at a disadvantage. They know that Canonical's pushing forward GNOME to the point where it's going to become, if anyone adopts Linux, that's going to be the distro they start with.
They should start with Mint instead.
They should. But what the distros should do with KDE is that they should work upstream, and they should start there. They should all collaborate upstream, because then they'll see the benefits and they'll reap the rewards later on. But no one's doing that.
Did you say rape the rewards?
Reap.
I'm pretty sure I heard rape.
There was a little bit of rapey in there. What I would suggest, gentlemen, is that we sort of wrap this particular audio recording segment
before we do that, I just want to let everybody know that, according to our good friend James Reddy, January 30th is officially Steal a Pen from a Bank Day.
No, but what I'm going to suggest is that we wrap up this particular audio recording and cut a new one, and that way we cut our losses in the event that something crashes when we hit the stop button.
Are you saying that our Dure is not the finest audio suite ever?
What we'll do is we're going to take a commercial break.
Yeah, commercial break. There is no editing in this podcast, by the way. None whatsoever.
Hi, I'm Danica Patrick from... We'll take a commercial break, throw on a song for you guys.
If you want to make an impression on the internet, I know something about speed, so if you want to make an impression on the internet fast...
What, like the drug?
Use GoDaddy. GoDaddy.
Yeah, by the way, GoDaddy, if you want to throw some money, we'll be more than happy to accept that, too.
We'll toss it back to James Reddy.
If I want to throw some money at GoDaddy, yeah, no, I don't think I want to.
The Linux experiment / GoDaddy.
Okay, we got to start making these pages. All right, so that's it for part one. Stay tuned after this awesome PodSafe music for part two. PodSafe.
Something beautiful. You told me that all you could hear was noise. Let's turn it into something beautiful.